Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours. Hello, pulpiteers, and welcome to Issue 30 of Protecting Project Pulp, the podcast that each week trolls the gin joints and Bowery bars of literature, searching for those unsung heroic tales of the golden age of pulp fiction, so we can restore them to their former glory in the arena of your ears. I'm your host, Dave Robison. Well, friends, this is my final episode with the mighty PPP, and we wanted to make it a memorable one. So we have two treats for you. The first is a tale from one of the icons of pulp fiction, Robert E. Howard. It's not Conan. It's not Solomon Kane. This is one of the less noted treasures of the Howard archives, a tale titled Waterfront Fists. This jewel first sparked a gleam in the eyes of pulp fiction fans in September of 1930, when it appeared in Fight Stories magazine. Now, PPP fans will recall this is the second Howard story we've showcased, the first being Gods of the North back in Issue 5. Check out that episode for our recap of the full scope and grandeur of Howard's career. But it bears mentioning here that boxing was one of Howard's passions. He grew up as a bookish boy in the town of Cross Plains, Texas, but he was a huge boxing fan, and in his teens started bodybuilding and eventually got into amateur boxing. Now, don't get me wrong, I loves me some Conan, but this story is special to me because in it, Howard gets to showcase his firsthand experience in the ring, and it's intriguing to listen to the subtle differences and similarities between Howard's treatment of a sword fight and a boxing match. I think you're really going to dig this. And I said we had two treats in store for you, right? Well, that's the first. The second will arrive after the story. So stay plugged in, gang. Your narrator for today's tale is Jim Phillips. Now, friends, if you're throwing a dinner party, Jim is the guy you want to invite. The dude has taken the phrase, "life is an adventure," pretty literally. He's traveled the deserts of the Middle East, forded rivers in the Caucasus, hacked his way through the jungles of India, and navigated the treacherous death trap that is Tokyo rush hour traffic. He holds numerous engineering degrees and is conversant in five languages, mostly so he can apply his silver tongue when accosted by local authorities or cutthroat smugglers. When not trying to recreate the life of Doc Savage, Jim lairs in a mountaintop retreat in Southern California, playing in the park with his young son, bombing through the mountains on a motorbike, and wondering why his daughter's university education is so bloody expensive. He's also the editor and publisher of the now mostly defunct literary fiction podcast Nil Desperandum, found on the web at ndstories.com, and the audio engineer for Crime City Central, our sister podcast here in the District of Wonders. Jim can be found on the web at worldtravelerjim.com, on Facebook at facebook.com/worldtravelerjim, or on Twitter at @travelerjim. Now, how about you get out of that fancy suit? Because there ain't no tuxes where we're going, boyo.
The Sea Girl hadn't been docked in Honolulu more than 3 hours before Bill O'Brien come legging it down to the pool hall where I was showing Mushy Hansen the fine points of the game to tell me that he'd got me matched up to fight some has-been at the American Arena that night. "The ruffian is in," said Bill, "and they got a fellow which they swear can take any man aboard the Sea Girl to a royal cleaning. I ain't seen him, but they say he growed up in the back country of Australia and run wild with the kangaroos till he was shanghaied aboard a ship at an early age. They say he's licked everybody aboard the ruffian from the cap'n down to the mess boy. Stow the gab and lead me to some ruffian idiots which is craving to risk their jack on this tramp," I interrupted. "I got $150 that's burning my pockets up." Well, it was easy to find some lunatics from the ruffian, and after putting up our money at even odds, with a bartender for stakeholder, and knowing I had a tough battle ahead of me and needed some training, I got me a haircut and then went down to the Hibernian bar for a few shots of hard liquor. While me and Bill and Bushy was lapping up our drinks, in comes Sven Larsen. This huge and useless Swede has long been laboring under the hallucination that he ought to be the champion of the Sea Girl, and no amount of battering has been able to quite wipe the idea out of what he supposes to be his brain. Well, this big mistake comes up to me, and scowling down at me, he said, "You Irisher, put up your hands." I set my liquor down with a short sigh of annoyance. With 1,000 sailors in port, itching for a scrap, I said, "You got to pick on me. Go on, I don't want to fight no shipmate now. Anyway, I got to fight the ruffian's man in a few hours."
"I should be fighting him," persisted the deluded maniac. "I ought to be champ of the Sea Girl. Come on, you big stiffer."
And so saying, he squared off in what he fondly believed was a fighting pose. At this moment, my white bulldog, Mike, sensing trouble, bristled and looked up from the bowl of beer he was lapping up on the floor. But seeing it was nobody but Sven, he curled up and went to sleep. "Don't risk your hands on the big chump, Steve," said Bill disgustedly. "I'll fix him."
"You stay out of this, Bill O'Brien," said the Swede,
waving his huge fists around menacingly.
"I will see to you after I lick Steve."
"Ah, you're drunk," I said. "A fine shipmate you are."
"I am not drunk," he roared.
"My girl told me." "I didn't know you had a girl here," said Bill.
"Well, I have. And she said a big man like me should be champion of his ship, and she wouldn't have nothing to do with me till I was. So put up your hands."
"Ah, you're crazy," I snapped, turning back to the bar, but watching him close from the corner of my eye, which was a good thing, because he started a wild right swing that had destruction wrote all over it. I sidestepped and he crashed into the bar. Rebounding with a bloodthirsty beller, he lunged at me. And seeing there was no arguing with the misguided heathen, I stepped inside his swing and brought up a right uppercut to the jaw that lifted his whole 245 pounds clean off the floor and stood him on the back of his neck, out cold. Mike, awakened by the crash, opened one eye, raised one ear, and then went back to sleep with sort of a gentle canine smile.
"You ought to be careful," growled Bill,
while Mushy sloshed a pitcher of dirty water over the Swede.
"You might have busted your hand. Why, you hit him in the stomach."
"I didn't want to upset his stomach," I said. "I've skinned my knuckles a little, but they ain't even bruised much. I've had him in too many buckets of brine." At last, Sven was able to sit up and cuss me, and he mumbled something I didn't catch.
"He says he's got a date with his girl tonight," Mushy said, "but he's ashamed to go back to her with that welt on his jaw and tell her he got licked."
"Yeah,"
said Sven, rubbing his jaw.
"You got to go tell her I can't come, Steve."
"Ah, well," I said. "All right. I'll tell her you fell off the docks and sprained your ankle." "Where's she live?"
"She dances at the Striped Cat Cabernet,"
said Steve. After downing a finger of old Jersey cream, I tightened my belt and me and Mike sauntered forth. Bill followed me out into the street and said,
"Doggone it, Steve, you ought not to go cruising off this way with the fight just a few hours in the offing. That ruffian crew is crooked as a bunch of snakes, and you know what a soft head you are where women is concerned."
"Your remarks is highly insulting, Bill," I returned with my well-known quiet dignity. "I don't reckon no woman ever made a fool out of me. I know him like a book. Anyhow, you don't think I'd fall for a dame as encouraged a sap like Sven, do you? Heck, she's probably some big fat wench with a face like a bull terrier. What'd he say her name was? Oh yeah, Gloria Finn. Don't you worry about me. I'll be at the American in plenty of time." It was after dark when me and Mike got to the Striped Cat Cabernet, which is located in a tough waterfront section of the city. I asked the manager for Gloria Finn, and he said she'd just finished a dance, was in her dressing room, changing to street clothes. He told me to wait for her at the back exit, which I done. I was standing there when the door opened, and some girls come out. I said, taking off my cap politely, "Which one of you frails is Gloria Finn, if any? You could have knocked me over with a pile driver when the snappiest, prettiest one of the bunch up and said, 'I'm her, and what of it?'" "Well," I said, eyeing her with great admiration, "all I can say is, what does a girl like you want to waste her time with such tripe as Sven Larsen when they is men like me in port?" "Don't get fresh," she snapped. "Oh, I ain't fresh," I assured her. "I just come to tell you that Sven fell off a dock and broke his neck. I mean, sprained his ankle, and he can't make the date tonight."
"Oh,"
she murmured. Then looking close at me, she said,
"Who are you?"
"I'm Steve Costigan, the fellow that licked him," I replied thoughtlessly.
"Oh," she said, kind of breathlessly. "So you're Steve Costigan."
"Yeah, I am," I said, having spilled the beans anyway. "Steve Costigan, A.B. Mariner and heavyweight champion aboard the Trader Sea Girl. I knowed you didn't know me, or you wouldn't have persuaded your boyfriend to risk his life by taking a swing at me." She looked kind of bewildered.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Oh, it's all right,"
I hastened to assure her. Sven told me about you urging him to climb me. But it's natural for a frail to want her fellow to be a champ of something. What I can't understand is what you see in a galoot like Sven. She gave kind of a hysterical laugh. Oh, I see. Why, Mr. Costigan?
Call me Steve, I beamed.
Well, Steve,
she said with a little embarrassed laugh.
I didn't urge him anything of the sort. I just said he was such a big fellow I bet he could whip anybody aboard his ship. And he said one of the other sailors, Steve Costigan, was champion. And I said I was surprised that anybody could lick him. Sven, I mean. Why, I had no idea he'd get it into his head I wanted him to fight anybody. I do hope you didn't hurt the poor boy.
Oh, not much, I said, unconsciously swelling out my huge chest. I always handle my shipmates easy as possible. Though, of course, I'm so powerful. Sometimes I hit harder than I intend to. But say, sister, I know a swell little girl like you wasn't taking that big squarehead serious. He was just sorry for him because he was so kind of big and awkward and dumb, weren't you?
Well, she admitted, that was the way of it. He looked lonesome.
Well, that's mighty fine of you, I said. But forget about him now. After the belt I gave him, he won't want to come back to you. And anyway, he'll find a native girl or a Chinese or something. He ain't like me. A woman's a woman to him, and he'll fall for anything in skirts that comes along. Me, I'm a one-woman man. Anyway, kid, it ain't right for you to trail around with a galoot like him. You owe it to yourself to keep company with only the best. Me, for instance.
Maybe you're right,
she said with downcast eyes. Sure, I'm always right, I answered modestly. Now what say we go in and lap up something? All this talking I've been doing's got my throat dry.
Oh, I never drink intoxicants, she said with a bright smile. If you don't mind, let's go over here to this ice cream parlor.
Okay with me, I said. But first let me introduce you to Mike, who can lick his weight both in wildcats and dog biscuits. Well, Mike, he shook hands with her, but he wasn't particular enthusiastic. He ain't no lady's dog. He treats him politely, but coldly. Then we went over to the joint where they sold ice cream, and while we was dawdling over the stuff, I let my eyes wander over my charming companion. She was a beauty, no doubt about it. Curly yellow hair and big, trusting violet eyes. What's a nice girl like you doing working in a dump like the Striped Cat? I asked her, and she kind of sighed and hung her head.
A girl has to do lots of things she don't like to do, she said. I was in a high-class dog company, which went broke here on account of the manager getting delirium tremens and having to be sent back to his home in England. I had to eat, and this was the only job open for me. Someday I'm going home. My folks live on a dairy farm in New Jersey, and I was a fool ever to leave there. Right now I can see the old white farmhouse and the green meadows with the babbling brooks running through them and the cows grazing.
I thought she was going to cry for a minute. Then she kind of sighed and smiled.
It's all in a lifetime, isn't it?
You're a brave kid, I said, touched to my shoe soles. And I want to see more of you. I'm fighting some guy at the American Arena in a little while. How about holding down a nice ringside seat there and then having supper and a little dancing afterwards? I can't dance much, but I'm a bear at the supper table.
Oh,
said she.
You're the man that's going to fight Red Roach?
Is that his name? I asked. Yeah, if he's the man from the ruffian.
I'd like to go, she said. But I have to go on in another dance number in half an hour.
Well, I said, the fight can't last more than 3 or 4 rounds. Not with me in there. How about me dropping around the Striped Cat afterwards? If you ain't through then, I'll wait for you.
That's fine, she said. And noting my slightly unsatisfied expression, she said, if I'd known you were going to fight so soon, I wouldn't have let you eat that ice cream.
Oh, that won't interfere with my punching ability any, I said. But I would like a shot of hard liquor to kind of settle it on my stomach. That's the truth. Sailors are supposed to be hogs about ice cream, and I have seen Navy boys eat it in disgusting quantities. But it's poor stuff for my belly. Mike ate the bowl full I gave him, but he'd a sight rather had a pan of slush.
Let's don't go in any of these saloons, said Gloria. These waterfront bars sell you the same stuff rattlesnakes have in their teeth. I tell you, I've got a bottle of rare old wine not very far from here. I never touch it myself, but I keep it for my special friends, and they say it's great. You've time for a nip, haven't you?
Lead on, sister, I said. I've always got time to take a drink, or oblige a beautiful girl.
Ah, you flatterer,
she said, giving me a little push.
I bet you tell that to every girl you meet.
Well, to my surprise, we halted before a kind of ramshackle gymnasium, and Gloria took out a key and unlocked the door.
I didn't tell you I had a kid brother with me,
she said in answer to my surprised glance.
He's a weakly sort of kid, and I have to support him as well as myself. Poor kid, he would come with me when I left home. Well, Mr. Solana, who owns the gym, lets him use the equipment to build himself up. It's healthy for him. This is the boy's key. I keep the wine hidden in one of the lockers.
Ain't this where Tony Andrada trains? I asked suspiciously. Because if it is, it ain't no place for a nice girl. They is fighters and fighters, my child, and Tony is no credit to no business.
He's always been a perfect gentleman towards me,
she answered.
Of course, I come here only occasionally when my brother is working out.
She opened the door and we went in, and then she shut it. To my slight surprise, I heard the click as she locked it. She switched on a light and I seen her bending over something. Then she swung around and, wow, I got the most unexpected, dumbfounding surprise of my life to date. When she turned, she had a heavy Indian club in both hands, and she heaved it up and crashed it down on my head with everything she had behind it. Well, I was so utterly dumbfounded, I just stood and gaped at her. And Mike, he nearly had a fit. I'd always taught him never to bite a woman, and he just didn't know what to do. Gloria was staring at me with eyes that looked like they was going to jump right out of her head. She glanced down at the broken fragments of the Indian club in a kind of stunned way, and then the color all ebbed out of her face, leaving her white as a ghost. That's a nice way to do a friend, I said reproachfully. I don't mind a joke, but you made me bite my tongue. She cringed back against the wall and held out both hands pitifully.
Don't hit me, she cried. Please don't hit me. I had to do it.
Well, if I ever seen a scared girl, it was then. She was shaking in every limb. You don't need to insult me on top of busting a club on my skull, I said with my quiet dignity. I never hit no woman in my life, and I ain't figuring on it. All at once, she began to cry.
Oh, said she, I'm ashamed of myself, but please listen. I've lied to you. My brother is a fighter, too, and he just had this fight with Red Roach when the promoter at the American changed his mind and signed you up instead. This fight would have given us enough to get back to New Jersey, where those cows are grazing by the babbling meadows. I thought when you told me you were the one that's going to fight Roach, I'd fix it so you wouldn't show up, and they'd have to use Billy. That's my brother, after all. I was going to knock you unconscious and tie you up till after the fight. Oh, I know you'll hate me, but I'm desperate. I'll die if I have to live this life much longer,
she said passionately. And then she starts to bawl. Well, I can't see as it was my fault, but I felt like a horse thief anyhow. Don't cry, I said. I'd help you all I can, but I got all my jack sunk on the imbroglio to win by a KO. She lifted her tear-stained face.
Oh, Steve, you can help me. Just stay here with me. Don't show up at the arena. Then Billy will get the fight and we can go home. Please, Steve, please, please, please.
She had her arms around my neck and was fairly shaking me in her eagerness. Well, I admit I got a soft spot in my heart for the weaker sex, but gee whiz. Great cats, Gloria, I said. I'd dive off the Statue of Liberty for you, but I can't do this. My shipmates has got every cent they got bet on me. I can't throw them down that way.
You don't love me,
she mourned. Oh, I do too, I protested. But doggone it, Gloria, I just can't do it. And please don't coax me, because it's like jerking a heartstring loose to say no to you. Wait a minute. I got an idea. You and your brother got some money saved up, ain't you?
Yes, some,
she sniffed, dabbling at her eyes with a foolish little lace handkerchief. Well, listen, I said. You can double it. Sink every cent you got on me to win by a KO. It'll be a cinch placing the dough. Everybody on the waterfront's betting one way or the other.
But what if you lose?
Said she. Me lose? I snorted. Don't make me laugh. You do that. And I can't stay another minute, kid. I'm due at the arena right now. And say, I'll have some dough myself after the battle. And I'm going to help you and your brother get back to them green cows and babbling farmhouses. Now I got to go. Before she had time to say another word, I kicked the lock off the door, being in too big a hurry to have her unlock it. And the next second, me and Mike was sprinting for the arena. I found Bill tearing his hair and walking the dressing room floor.
Here you are at last, you blankety-blank McDipthong,
he yelled bloodthirstily.
Where you been? You want to make a nervous wreck out of me? You realize you've been committing the one unpardonable sin by keeping the crowd waiting for 15 minutes? They're yelling bloody murder, and the crew, which is all out in the ringside seats, have been throwing chairs at the ruffian's men, which has been howling you'd run out on us. The promoter says if you ain't in that ring in 5 minutes, he'll run in a substitute.
And I'll run him into the bay, said I, sitting down and shucking my shoes. I gotta get my wind back a little. Boy, we had Sven's girl down all wrong. She's a peach, as well as being a square-shooting. Shut up and get into them trunks, howled Bill, doing a war dance on the cap I just took off.
You'll never learn nothing. Listen to that crowd. We'll be lucky if they don't lynch all of us.
Well, the maddened fans was making a noise like a flock of hungry lions, but that didn't worry me none.
I just got into my fighting togs when the door opened, and the manager of the arena stuck a pale face in.
"I got a man in place of Costigan,"
he began, when he saw me and stopped.
"Gangway,"
I snarled, and as I pushed by him, I saw a fellow in trunks coming out of another dressing room. To my amazement, it was Tony Andrada, which even had his hands taped. His jaw fell when he seen me, and his manager, Abe Gold, gave a howl. There was two other thugs with him, Solana and Joe Cromwell. I'd been in Honolulu enough to know them yeggs. "What do you think you're doing here?" I snarled, facing Tony.
"They want me to fight Roach. When you run out..."
he begun. Bill grabbed my arm as I was making ready to slug him. "For cat's sake," he snarled. "You can lick him after you flatten Roach if you want to. Come on." "It's mighty funny he should turn up right at this time," I growled. "I thought Billy Flynn was to fight Roach if I didn't show up." "Who's Billy Flynn?" asked Bill as he rushed me up the aisle between howling rows of infuriated fans. "My new girl's kid brother," I answered as I clung through the ropes. If they did anything to him, all... My meditations was drowned by the thunders of the mob, who gave me cheers because I got there, and razzes because I hadn't got there sooner. On one side of the ring, the Seagirl's crew lifted the roof with their wild whoops, and on the other side, the ruffians' roughnecks greeted me with coarse, rude squawks and impolite remarks. Well, I glanced over to the opposite corner and saw Red Roach for the first, and I hope the last time. He was tall and raw-boned, and the ugliest human I ever seen. He had freckles as big as mess pans all over him. His nose was flat, and his low, slanting forehead was topped by a shock of the most scandalously red hair I ever looked at. When he rose from the stool, I seen he was knock-kneed, and when we come to the center of the ring to pretend to listen to instructions, I was disgusted to note that he was also cross-eyed. At first, I thought he was counting the crowd, and it was slightly disconcerting to finally decide he was glaring at me. We went back to our corners. The gong sounded, the scrap started, and I got another jolt. Roach come out, right foot and right hand forward. He was left-handed. I was so disgusted I come near lightning and giving him a good cussing. Red-headed, cross-eyed, and left-handed. And he was the first good port-sider I'd ever met in a ring. I forgot to say our weights was 190 for me and 193 for him. In addition, he was 6'3", or just 3 inches taller than me, and he must have had a reach of anyways 15 fathoms. When we was still so far apart, I didn't think he could reach me with a pole when, bam! His right licked out to my chin. I give a roar and plunged in, meaning to make it a quick fight. I wanted to crush this inhuman freak before the sight of him got on my nerves and rattled me. But I was all at sea. A left-hander does everything backwards. He leads with his right and crosses his left. He sidesteps to the left instead of the right ordinarily. This guy done everything a port sider's supposed to do, and a lot more stuff he thought up for himself. He had a fast, hard, straight right, and a wicked left swing. Oh boy, how he could hit with that left. Seemed like every time I did anything, I got that right in the eye, or the mouth, or on the nose, and whilst I was thinking about that, bam, come the left and nearly ripped my head clean off. The long, lanky mutt. It looked like if I ever landed solid, I'd bust him in two. But I couldn't get past that long, straight right. My swings were all short, and his straight right beat my left hook every time. When I tried trading jabs with him, his extra reach ruined that. Anyway, I'm a natural hooker. My straight left has got force, but it ain't as accurate as it should be. At the end of the first round, my right ear was nearly mangled. In the second frame, he half-closed my eye with a sizzling right hook and opened a deep gash on my forehead. At the beginning of the third, he dropped me for no count with a left hook to the body that nearly caved me in. The ruffian's crew was getting crazier every second, and the Seagirl's gang was yelling bloody murder. But I wasn't worried. I'm used to more punishment than I was getting, and I wasn't weakening any. But doggone it, it did make me mad not to be able to hit Roach. To date, I hadn't landed a single solid punch. He was a clever boxer in his way, and his style would have made Dempsey look like a one-armed paper hanger carrying a bucket. He managed to keep me at long range, and he belted me plenty, but it wasn't his speed nor his punch that kept me all at sea. It was his cruel and unusual appearance. Doggone, them eyes of his nearly had me batty. I couldn't keep from looking at him. I tried to watch his waistline, or his feet, but every time my gaze would wander back to his distorted optics. They had a kind of fatal attraction for me. Whilst I would be trying to figure out where they was looking, wham, would come that left, winging in from an entirely unexpected direction. And this continued. Well, after arising from that knockdown in the third frame, I was infuriated. And after chasing him all around the ring, and getting only another black eye for my pains, I got desperate. With around half a minute to go, I wowed the audience by closing both my eyes and tearing in, swinging wild and regardless. He was pelting me plenty, but I didn't care. That visage of his wasn't upsetting all my calculations, as long as I couldn't see it. And in a second, I felt my left crash against what I knew to be a human jaw. Instantly, the crowd went into hysterics, and I opened my eyes and looked for the corpse. My eyes rested on a recumbent figure, but it was not Red Roach. To my annoyance, I realized that one of my blind swings had connected with the referee. At the same instant, Roach's swinging left crashed against my jaw and I hit the canvas. But even as I went down, I swung a wild, dying effort right, which sunk in just above Red's waistline. The round ended with all three of us on the canvas. Our respective handlers dragged us to our corners, and somebody threw a bucket of water on the referee, who was able to answer the gong with us battlers by holding on to the ropes. Well, as I sat in my corner sniffing the smelling salts and watching Red's handlers massaging his suffering belly, I thought deeply. A very rare habit of mine while fighting. I do not believe in too much thinking. It gives a fighter the headache. Still and all, with my jaw aching from Red's left and my eyes getting strained from watching his unholy face, I rubbed the nose Mike stuck into my glove and meditated. A left-hander is a right-hander backwards. 9 times out of 10, his straight right will beat your left jab. If you lead your right to a right-hander, he'll beat you to the punch with his left. But you can lead your right to a left-hander, because his left has as far to travel as your right. So when we come out for the fourth round, instead of tearing in, I went in cautious-like for me, ignoring the yells of the ruffian's crew that I was getting scared of their man. Red fainted with his right so clumsy, even I knowed it was a feint, and instantly shot my right with everything I had behind it. It beat his left swing, and landed solid, but high. He staggered, and I dropped him to his all fours with a whistling left hook under the heart. He was up at 9, and caught me with a wild left swing as I rushed in. It dizzied me, but I kept coming. And every time he made a motion with his left, I shot my right. Sometimes I landed first, and sometimes he did, and sometimes we landed simultaneous. But my smashes had the most kick behind them. Like most portsiders when they're groggy, he'd clean forgot he had a right hand, and was staking everything on his left swing. I battered him back across the ring, and he rallied and smashed over a sledgehammer left hook that rocked me to my heels and made the blood spatter. But I bored right in with a sizzling left hook under the heart. He gasped, his knees buckled, then he steadied himself and shot over his left just as I crashed in with a right. Bam! Something exploded in my head, and then I heard the referee counting. To my chagrin, I found I was on the canvas. But Roach was there, too. The still-weaving and glassy-eyed referee was holding onto the ropes with one hand and counting over us both, but I managed to reel up at 6. Me and Red had landed square to the button at just the same second, but my jaw was just naturally tougher than his. He hadn't twitched at 10, and they had to carry him to his dressing room to bring him to. Well, a few minutes' work on me with smelling salts, ammonia, sponges, and the like made me as good as new. I couldn't wait for Bill to dress my cuts with collodion, but the minute I got my clothes on and collected my winnings and bets from the bartender who'd come to the ring under escort from both ships, I ducked out the back way. I even left Mike with Bill because he's always scrapping with some other dog on the streets, and I was in a big hurry. I was on my way to see if Gloria had followed my advice. Also something else. $150 I'd won. With what I had, that made 300. I got 150 for the fracas. Altogether, I had $450, all in greenbacks of large denomination in my jacket pocket, and I was going to give Gloria every cent of it, if she'd take it, so she could go back to New Jersey in the cows. This sure wasn't no place for a nice girl to be in, and I'll admit I indulged in some dreams as I hurried along, about the time I'd retire from the sea, and maybe go into the dairy farming business in New Jersey. I was headed for the Striped Cat, but on my way I passed Solana's gym, and I noticed that there was a light on in one of the small rooms which served as a kind of office. As I passed the door, I distinctly heard a voice I knowed was Gloria's. I stopped short and started to knock on the door. Then something made me steal up close and listen, though I ain't a eavesdropper by nature. From the voices, 5 people was in the room. Gloria, Solana, Abe Gold, Joe Cromwell, and Tony.
"Don't hand us no line, sister,"
Gold was saying in his nasty, rasping voice.
"You said leave it to you. Yeah, we did. And look what it cost us. You was going to keep Costigan out of the way so as we could run Tony in at the last minute. You know the promoter at the American was all set to match Tony with Roach when Costigan's ship docked and the big cheese changed his mind and matched the Mick instead, because the fool sailors wanted the scrap. Roach would have been a spread for Tony, because the wop eats these portsiders up. The town sports know that, and they would have sunk heavy on Tony. We was going to bet our shirts on Roach. Tony would flap along about the third. Then we could all left this dump and gone to Australia. Well, we left it up to you to get rid of Costigan. And what does he do? I asked you. He walks in as big as you please, just when Tony was fixing to go in for him. I ask you. Well, don't rag me, said Gloria, in a voice which startled me. It was that hard. I did my best. I got a hold of a Swede aboard the Sea Girl and primed the big stiff proper. I stirred him up and sent him down to Clyde Costigan, thinking he'd bung the Mick up so he couldn't come on tonight, or that Costigan would at least break his hands on him. But the heart flattened him without even spraining a thumb, and the first thing I knew he was waiting for me outside the cabaret. I thought he'd come down to smack me for sicking the Swede on him, but the big slob had just come to tell me the squarehead couldn't keep his date. Can you feature that? Well, he fell for me right off, naturally. And I got him into the gym here, intending to lay him cold and lock him up till after the fight. But say, that big Mick must have a skull made of reinforced battleship steel. I shattered a 5-pound Indian club over his dome without even making him bat his eyes. Well, I hope I never have a half-minute like that again. When I failed to even stagger him with that clout, I thought I was a gone goose. I had visions of him twisting my head off and feeding it to that ugly cannibal he calls his bulldog. But you can't tell about those tough-looking sluggers like him. He didn't even offer to lay a hand on me. And when I got my second win, I spun him a yarn about having a kid brother that needed this fight to get back home. He fell for it so easy that I thought I could coax him to run out on his own accord. But he balked there. All he'd do was to advise me to bet on him. And then all at once he said it was time for him to be at the stadium. And he busted right out through the door and took it on the lam, making some crack about coming back after the fight. A fine mess you've made, sneered Zelana. You've gummed things up for proper. We had everything set for a killing. A high-class brand of sports you are, she snapped. I'm ashamed to be seen with you, you cheap grafters. A big killing. You don't know what one is. Anyway, what do you want me to do, cry? We want you to give back that 100 we paid you in advance, snarled Zelana. And if you don't, you'll cry plenty. And I guess you think I risked my life for such cheap welchers as you for nothing, she sneered. Not 1 cent. There was the sound of a blow, and Gloria gave a short, sharp cry, which was cut short in a sort of gasp. Give her the works, Joe, Zelana snarled. You can't cross me, you little.
Never mind what he called her. I'd have half killed him for that alone. I tore the door clean off the hinges as I went through it, and I seen a sight that made a red mist wave in front of me, so everything in that room looked bloody and grim. Zelana had Gloria down on a chair, and was twisting both her arms up behind her back till it looked like they'd break. Joe Cromwell had the fingers of his left hand sunk deep in her white throat, and his right drawn back to smash in her face. Tony and Abe Gold was looking on with callous, contemptuous sneers. They all turned to look as the door crashed in, and I saw Zelana go white as I gave one roar and went into action. He turned loose of the girl, but before he could get his hands up, I crashed him with a left-hander that crushed his nose and knocked out 4 teeth, and my next smash tore Joe Cromwell's ear loose and left it hanging by a shred. Another of the same sort stood him on his head in a corner with a cracked jawbone, and almost simultaneous Abe Gold barely missed me with a pair of brass knuckles, and Tony landed hard on my ear. But I straightened with a right-hander that dropped Gold across Zelana with 3 broken ribs and missed a left swing that wouldst have decapitated Tony had it landed. I ain't one of these fellows which has to be crazy mad to put up a good fight, but when I am crazy mad, there's no limit to the destruction I can hand out. Maybe in the ring, under ordinary circumstances, Tony could have cut me to ribbons. But here, he never had a chance. I didn't even feel the punches he was raining on me, and after missing a flock of swings in a row, I landed under his jaw with a haymaking right-hander that I brought up from the floor. Tony turned a complete somersault in the air, and when he come down, his head hit the wall with a force that laid his scalp open, and Woodston knocked him cold, if he hadn't already been unconscious before he landed. Maybe a minute and a half after I busted through the door, I stood alone in the middle of the carnage, panting and glaring down at the 4 silent figures which littered the room. All I craved was for all the other yeggs in Honolulu to come busting in. Pretty soon I looked around for Gloria and saw her cringing in a corner, like she was trying to flatten herself out against the wall. She was white-faced, and her eyes were blazing with terror. She gave kind of a hunted cry when I looked at her.
Don't! Please don't!
Please don't what? I snapped in some irritated. Ain't you learned by this time that I don't clout frails? I come in here to rescue you from these jipes, and you insult me.
Forgive me, she begged. I can't help but be a little afraid of you. You look so much like a gorilla.
What?
I mean, you're such a terrible fighter,
she hastily amended.
Come on, let's get out of here before these welchers come too.
Would that they wouldst, I brooded. What I done to him was just a sample of what I'm going to do to him. Doggone it, some of these days somebody's going to upset my temper. Then I'll lose control of myself and hurt somebody. Well,
We went out on the street, which was mostly deserted and rather dimly lighted, and Gloria said pretty soon, "Thank you for rescuing me. If my brother had been there..."
"Gloria," I said wearily, "ain't you ever going to stop lying? I was outside the door and heard it all."
"Oh,"
said she. "Well," I said, "I reckon I'm a fool when it comes to women. I thought I was stuck on you and didn't have sense enough to know you was stringing me. Why, I even brung the $450 I won, intending to give it to you." And so saying, I threw out the wad of bills, waved it reproachfully in front of her eyes, and replaced it in my jacket pocket. All at once she started crying.
"Oh, Steve, you make me ashamed of myself. You're so fine and noble."
"Well," I said with my quiet dignity, "I know it, but I can't help it. It's just my nature."
"I'm so ashamed,"
she sobbed.
"There's no use lying. Solana paid me $100 to get you out of the way. But, Steve, I'm changing my ways right here. I'm not asking you to forgive me, because I guess it's too much to ask, and you've done enough for me. But I'm going home tomorrow. That stuff I told you about the dairy farm in New Jersey was the only thing I told you that wasn't a lie. I'm going home and live straight, and I want to kiss you just once, because you've showed me the error of my ways."
And so saying, she threw her arms around me and kissed me vigorously, and me not objecting in no manner.
"I'm going back to the old, pure, simple life," she said. "Back to the green meadows and babbling cows."
And she made off down the street at a surprising rate of speed. I watched her go, and a warm glow spread over me. After all, I thought, I do know women, and the hardest of them is softened by the influence of a strong, honest, manly heart like mine. She vanished around a corner, and I turned back toward the Hibernian bar, at the same time reaching for my bankroll. Then I gave a yell that woke up everybody in that section of Honolulu with cold sweat standing out on them. Now I knowed why she wanted to put her arms around me. My money was gone. She loved me. She loved me not.
You just heard Waterfront Fists by Robert E. Howard, read by Jim Phillips. And friends, nobody wrote pulp like Howard. And that's one of the things I just love about the pulp authors is that they were all over the genre map. I mean, I got hooked on Howard like many of you did through the Conan novels. So it's really cool to hear Howard's authorial voice speaking through a story that doesn't involve broadswords and Stygian wizards. I'm so glad that we could give you that delicious pulpy treat for my final episode as your host. But I have one more treat for you. Actually, kind of a double treat. You've heard the auditory artistry of our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, since we started this podcast. And I really wanted to prove to you that Tom is more than just a maniacal sound junkie wired into his patch panels and mixers with XLR cables for veins and an oscilloscope for eyes. So I've invited him to join us on this momentous episode to make it even that much more momentous. Oh, but wait. There's more. There's no way I'm going to leave you in the hands of a new host without giving him a proper handoff and a good grilling to make sure he's got what it takes to pilot the helm of this mad pulpy ship. So, friends, please join me in welcoming to the PPP Virtual Studio our auditory wizard, Tom O'Dwyer, and our new host for Protecting Project Pulp, Simon Hildebrandt. Tom, Simon, gentlemen, thank you so much for making the time for this little digital tete-a-tete. Tom, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, thank you. I'd like to clarify, I do have oscilloscopes for eyes.
See, there you go. And that's the wonder of audio fiction is that, you know, from now on, whenever Simon mentions your name, we're going to see this little waveform across your face like a Cylon. That's awesome. And Simon, how are you, sir?
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. I am so looking forward to speaking with you. But Simon, just chillax for just a second, because this is a rare opportunity. Tom and I were talking before we started recording that I've never actually heard his voice ever. So it's a wonderful, fitting, and slightly tearful moment that I get to spend a couple of minutes with Tom here. So Tom, first of all, where are you?
And what do you do when you're not mixing episodes for protecting Project Pulp?
Well, I'm originally from Cheltenham in England, rather middle class, nice area. But I've moved to Bristol, which more of the listeners might know.
Yeah.
I moved here for uni when I did audio production, hence the work in PPP. But I've fallen into website design, and I build websites for a small company now in Bristol, which is not exactly how I planned it going, but it's good fun. And
absolutely, yeah. If you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans, because this is going to change, baby. Well, Bristol's awesome. There's a great fantasy con in Bristol. Have you ever made that scene?
No, I'm more of the music than the literature. I still enjoy still enjoy reading and that sort of. Audiobooks get me through my commute. I have an hour commute each way to my job, so audiobooks and podcasts make that. But the music scene here is great, and it's a vibrant city. I love it.
Outstanding. And is that what got you into audio production? Was interest in music, or how did you wend your way into those dark, shadowy realms?
I've always been a big music fan, and I don't know how to explain this. The UK schooling system, you sort of leave at 16 and there's an optional bit, and I changed school at 16, and one of the options was audio technology, and I thought, great, I'll go and try this out, and found out that things I just knew and took for granted about knowing stuff about microphones were apparently clever, and so I became really clever at one thing, so I thought, this is brilliant, I'll just keep doing this. They pulled out a tube condenser in the first thing, and were like, does anybody know what this is? And I was like, oh, it's just a tube condenser microphone. All these heads turn around, like, who is this person? What does he know?
That's awesome, and what a wonderful treat to discover that something that you love so much is something that you can actually ply your craft at. That's fabulous.
Well, yeah, when I found out I could go to university and study, just basically listen to songs, and if I can identify what a thing is, I get a good grade. It's brilliant. I loved it. And even more confusingly, for my dissertation, my main project in the end of my third year, I made a film. So there we go. Just to complete the set.
There you go. He does everything. He does it all. So Tom, you're working on websites. You're obviously a brilliant sound monkey, and clearly you have taste in music and film. Where do you see yourself going in the next 5 years? Do you have any plans, or are you just letting the universe show you the way?
Well, the dream since I've been about 11 or 12 years old was rock star or football/soccer manager. So I've tended towards the rock star thing now, sort of. Being able to use a studio consistently and record bands, even if it's not making money, something like that would be great. Have my own place to record my band, other bands. It'd be good fun.
Are you in a band?
Yes, but not good enough that I'm going to have any sort of promotion for them on this podcast.
Well, you know, Simon, somewhere down the road, once Tom's band gets their act together and they're taking the stage, you got to bring them back and get an update on does the band have a name?
The band's called Shallow Means. We've got domains and we've got Facebooks and Twitters, but they're all unpublished because we're not confident enough. Spend like a day setting it all up and then just nothing.
Oh, that's awesome, Tom. Holy crap. See, and I'm glad that at least now we get to share these moments and this information. Maybe Simon will have me back from time to time and we can do like a co-host thing and we'll get the whole gang together and we'll talk pulp at the end of the show.
It'll be like the good old days.
In the good old days. Yeah, absolutely. So, and speaking of Master Simon, first of all, welcome to the slightly uncomfortable but nevertheless sturdy chair at the helmsman's seat of Protecting Project Pulp, sir. I got to ask, you know, where are you, first of all, because the potosphere can be anywhere. And what do you do when you're not cramming pulp fiction into your head?
Yeah, we've had this conversation a few times, haven't we, that it's strangely ethereal, that the voices just come out of the void and they could be on any side of the planet.
Yeah, really?
Yeah. Well, I'm down in Sydney. And just to create just to complete the trifecta, Because you're a web developer as well, aren't you, Dave?
I am.
And absolutely. So am I.
We're all a couple of trinity of web geeks here at the Project
Taking
Pulp.
Over.
We do. We rule. We totally rule.
Well, I have this theory that in the future, the world will be mostly the internet, people on the internet, and people making the internet for the people who are on the internet.
That's right. There'll be no actual product or anything like that. It's just this self-perpetuating Ouroboros of web development feeding on itself. Absolutely.
So, Simon, what was it about the Protecting Project Pulp that made you want to be host? What made you into the man who is to take over from Dave?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have been listening to what's become the District of Wonders for quite a few years now. Actually, it all started while I was living in Amsterdam for a couple of years with my wife, and I had a similar commute as what you've described from Leiden to Amsterdam. It's 45 minutes, and you go through the international airport, and believe me, at that point you want to have something in your ears blocking out the noise of
anything.
drunken English tourists going to Amsterdam to get stoned.
Well, hey.
Is it true? Is it true, Tom?
I'm probably the only person out of my friend group who hasn't done that.
Wow.
So you got into it with trying to drown out the sound of drunken tourists and fill that 45 minutes. That got you hooked?
Yeah. And, you know, the more that you work, the more you commute, the less time you have to soak up your traditional fiction fare. So my stack of William Gibson's and Neal Stephenson's and stuff at home was kind of going unread. So it was awesome to be able to pick up this and Escape Pod and, you know, various other things that were lying around and get my fiction fix. And from then on, yeah, Tony's got this great sort of DIY attitude where he just asks everyone to pitch in. And I think we've all had that experience where he just sort of says, look, I need help. Please, if there's anything you guys can contribute, jump in.
Just do it.
And yeah, and so I've been at it for years with narrations. I've got a bunch of fact articles on the Starship Sofa at the moment called Gaming the Future. I even took a swing at building a mobile app, Sofa Stream, which was designed to just try and make it a bit easier for people to get into the show and soak up the goodness that's there.
Dude, that's badass. Is that still available out there?
It is. It's kind of fallen a bit behind because, you know, all the other things that I'm working on.
Sure.
And moving around from the Netherlands, back to Melbourne, then up to Sydney. And having a two-year-old really sort of eats into your time for that sort of stuff.
Oh, man.
But
wow.
There is a refresh in the future at some stage that I'm really looking forward to working on.
That's awesome. That's very cool. So you were doing narrations, you did some of the articles, and you've been a part of it for a few years now, right?
Yeah, I've been bouncing off Tony for, you know, 3 or 4 years at least. And just whenever he's got a question at something technical or, you know, he wants to experiment with something or recommendations, it's just been nice to be able to chip in any way that helps him.
Okay. But so obviously you're a joiner. You get into it. You have the literary vibe working for you. But that doesn't answer Tom's question. There's a lot of people out there that have similar qualities, and they're not stepping up to be host of the mighty PPP. So I'm really curious to ask you, what made you take this extra step?
Well, it was a big one. It was pretty tough. I've loved doing the narrations, and it's been incredible to learn so much about fiction and the way it can be presented. And with the fact articles, trying to put, you know, a very different voice look. Well, my voice, really, for the first time, it really built my confidence and just got me thinking that, you know, that's definitely something that I can do. And then when, you know, I heard that you had so much else on your plate that you were going to have to step down, I thought that maybe it was really time to step up and try the host stuff for real and make the serious contribution.
Well, and you distinguished yourself among the herd, and it was a very select herd, I will tell you. And there was a lot of very strong submissions that were put forth. But I got to say, Simon, you shone. There was a quality about you that distinguished you very clearly, and I'm really looking forward to seeing where you take this mad pulpy ship that Tom and Fred and I have been driving for 30 episodes now.
Well, it's very kind of you to say, and I think one of the biggest parts for me, because when the when it originally came around, when Tony originally sort of forked off the other shows, I sort of thought about it then, but I didn't really have a clear idea of what the show could possibly be like, and so I kind of hung back a bit. But seeing what you've done with the show and the sort of tone that you set really gave me a clear sense of how awesome the show could be, and that was where I kind of went, right, okay, now that's a tradition that I can definitely get excited about and want to carry forward.
That's awesome. Thank you, man. I'm glad I could create a foundation for others to build upon. So that's now. What about Pulp Fiction, Simon? What's your take on Pulp Fiction? What does it mean to you? And what is it that really gets your pulse going? Because I know it does.
Well, it's a good question. For me, Pulp really represents humanity at its most sort of rawly creative. I've actually got a copy of A.E. Van Vogt's Mission to the Stars actually sitting on my desk in front of me.
Oh, wow.
And it's just, for me, it really embodies everything about Pulp that gets me excited. It's really just chock full of pulpy goodness. It's one of those. It's got one of those crazy stainless steel sort of robots on the cover.
The trash cans with legs.
Yeah, well, this is one of those ones with sort of light bulbs for ears. And it's, oh, wait, oh, my God, it's got oscilloscopes for eyes.
It's Tom O'Dwyer.
I knew I shouldn't have posed for that stock photo.
Comes back to haunt you every time.
I'm totally posting a picture of this on the Facebook, et cetera, later.
Absolutely.
And, the hooks for claws and, you know, it's twiddling some crazy retro sort of console with the knobs and radar scopes and things. And it's just, it's so over the top and so cool. And ever since I was a kid, I've been looking at these sorts of covers and analog magazines and all sorts of stuff and just being totally inspired and really wanting to know what the world might be that's behind that cover.
It really does. I mean, those covers more than anything, well, the stories, of course, are the heart of it, but the covers that they inspired and the almost, I mean, you could really call it an artistic style that evolved. Many artists got their start creating that very thematic, you know, lurid, you know, the for the gumshoes, you got the women in the lingerie, which was racy back then. Nowadays, Victoria's Secret's got that nailed. And then, like, you know, the light bulbs for ear robots and so on, and the jungles and the aliens and all of that. It's God, there's just so much.
It's the album sleeve before you get to the music. It's the sort of getting you in the mood before you even really know what the mood is.
That's it. Brilliant. Yes, exactly. That's exactly it.
And it's interesting when you hear Tony talk and he talks about the covers of the books that he's found so compelling. And I always found it a little weird because he would say, oh, you know, it's got this incredible cover, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, that's kind of an odd way to approach a piece of fiction that you love. But I think now that I've looked at the Pulp stuff and I've really thought about the relationship, the symbiotic relationship between those lurid covers and the Pulp fiction, it's the whole package that really gets people's mind in the right place for the fiction they're about to soak up.
You really can't separate one from the other when you think about it, because certainly when I know when I'm listening to the stories on the show, we've all seen those covers so often that imagery, that visual that's established by those covers really kind of plays out. It informs the film in your head that's playing while you listen to the story. I had never considered that, but that's brilliant. Tom, I'm curious, do you have a Pulp love, or is it all about the sound for you?
It's almost going to sound a bit stupid, but I like the snappiness, the shortness. They tend to be to the point tales, almost. Like I coming into this, I was a bit daunted that I might have to deal with like 2 hour long narrations of things, because I didn't really know about Pulp Fiction. And you get a lot of these well crafted, well written stories that come in at 30 minutes, and it's I can only really compare it to music, as that's my forte. I love Led Zeppelin's epics, but I'll be damned if I don't love a good short punk song as well. It's still got the same beauty, and it's not that I don't enjoy verbose literature that goes on for a long time, but it's just the, I like that it's snappy and to the point and still interesting and filled with knowledge and wonder and whatever else they want to throw in there.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, because they were written for these, you know, shorter magazines and so on, per force they had to be tight. So, and it's interesting because they were getting paid by the word, and you can tell sometimes in the descriptions, oh boy, he was padding his paycheck with that description. but even then, you're right. There is a sharp tempo. There is a distinct rhythm to the pulp vibe. And I think for the first 30 episodes, we've really laid that down pretty strongly.
I'd have to agree with that. For me, one of the signal virtues of pulp fiction is that, I mean, some genre fiction authors can be a bit cautious or sort of self-conscious, or maybe even they try and limit themselves to what can happen in the real world. Pulp authors never sort of make that mistake. That's the real signal virtue of pulp for me. They're not boring, and, you know, even if they are a bit over the top or politically incorrect, they get into the action so quick, and they just, you know, really pound through it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's awesome. That's awesome. And I'm looking forward to seeing, to tuning in afterwards, after I've passed off the golden microphone over to you, Simon, and continuing to enjoy this stuff, because it really is awesome. So now, Simon, I got to ask, and I'm curious about this. Do you have any plans specifically for the future of the PPP? Any visions of literary domination or giving away cars or anything like that? What do you see for on down the road for the Protecting Project Pulp?
Well, if we're giving away cars, I guess they're going to have to be flying ones.
Definitely, or jetpacks, one of the two.
Me first.
Absolutely.
Tom's right in front there.
But in all seriousness, I've been giving it a lot of thought. And for me, the whole show, Protecting Project Pulp, is really a kind of archaeology as we dig back into this place and time in history and the fiction that came from it, this rawly creative fiction. And one of the most interesting things for me about archaeology is seeing the traces in the present and the future of that historic material. And I think there's so much now, so much retro-tinged stuff and so many ideas, like flying cars, etc., it just keeps coming back, that got its start in that time. And we can trace that and look at all sorts of different things. And so that's something I'm really interested to do. I want to start tying each story that we do into its current context and start thinking about stuff like, you know, if you're watching Futurama and they've got that big retro spaceship and they're all wearing rings at, you know, retro nightclubs and stuff, and it's just it's so self-conscious of its sources of what came before. And I mean, if you look at authors like Warren Ellis and his Authority series, mm-hmm. He explicitly name checks and points to, you know, the Doc Savage sort of era, and he does a whole comic on that and how it inspires everything that we do now. And I just feel like there's so many. Or Fringe, if you've watched Fringe.
Oh my God, yes.
Creepy men in hats. It's so pulp. It's just untrue. And I really want people to start thinking about that sort of stuff.
I think that's outstanding. I think that's an awesome way to honor the heritage and the foundation that pulp laid for all of the genres that have evolved from it. That's brilliant, Simon. I can see that we're leaving the fans in good hands with you at the helm. What do you think, Tom? Are we okay with this? Can we let Simon take over? You think he's got the chops?
I'm happy with it so far. We've got to see what kind of effort he puts in on that first episode. I think it's still walking the tightrope for me, to be honest. It's got time to shine.
There we go. There we go. Those first few episodes, Simon, everybody's watching you, man. No pressure. No pressure. Oh, man. Well, friends, I got to tell you, I hope you enjoyed not only today's story, but this opportunity to duck behind the scenes, meet Tom O'Dwyer, our oscilloscope-faced sound dude, and your new host for Protecting Project Pulp, Simon Hildebrandt. Now, remember,
Dave, I've got to interrupt you quickly.
What?
I don't know if you can hear that background sound, but it's a round of applause for you. There we go. And There's the champagne going off.
Oh, my God.
Glasses for everybody.
Oh, yes. Awesome.
And we're clinking. Oh, clinking of glasses. Isn't that brilliant?
That's marvelous. That's marvelous. I can hear all of that. And already I'm rushing to my folder of sound effects and trying to find a way to make that work.
30 episodes of heroic work, man.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen, very much. I'm honored. I really am. This has been a rare opportunity for me to not only explore or at least to start exploring the depths and the wonder of pulp, but also to work with an astonishing team. Tom and Fred have been awesome. Tony has been very supportive of everything, and it's opened up a whole new vista of opportunities for me. And I will always be deeply grateful.
On a serious note, thank you for your efforts. You put in a lot of work, and while sometimes it has been late and it has been rushed in last minute, for the most part, it's been good.
Yeah, yes.
It's been good fun. And on a personal note, you've given me 30 quotes for my CV every week. So,
oh, yeah. And that's all yours, man. I attach no copyright to that. That's all yours.
Brilliant.
Use as you will. Yeah, Simon, I've kind of made life a little easier for you. If you get your stuff in even remotely on time, you're going to be a freaking rock star with these guys, because that was one of my foibles.
Awesome. At least you've set the bar at a relatively comfortable level, so I won't feel too much pressure.
Exactly. Yes. So, friends, do keep in mind that there's no need to take on a horde of Bowery bums to get your weekly dose of pulpy goodness. You can just stroll your way on down to iTunes and subscribe to Protecting Project Pulp there, or make your way out to our website, www.protectingprojectpulp.com. You can also leave a comment on the post or join in on our forums there. Now, next week, I have no frickin' idea what's going to happen. Simon, do you have any idea what our listeners can look forward to?
Well, there's a lot of great fiction coming up, and it's been incredibly difficult to pick something, but S10 Ike Burke has a wonderful story called The Tigress Terrible, and I think we're definitely going to have to lead with that.
Outstanding. Well, there you go, friends. The Protecting Project Pulp tradition continues in fine style and in good hands. So, dear friends, this is my farewell. I definitely want to thank Fred Heimbaugh and you, Tom, for everything that you guys have done and will continue to do in the service of making this a fabulous podcast. And I know Simon will be blazing new trails of pulpy awesomeness for everyone. It has been my privilege and my singular pleasure to plumb the depths and soar the heights of the pulp fiction wilderness with you all. And I'll be back, actually, from time to time, because I'm going to be narrating a few of these tales. And maybe Simon will have me back. We can do a team hosting event from time to time. Because honestly, friends, as you well know, once you mainline a few cc's of pulp fiction, baby, it's in your blood forever. Until I see you again, I am Dave Robison, wishing you always that you find nothing but the finest adventures. Take care.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.